The history of political ideas had started from the conventional assumption that there are ideas and they have a history, and that the history of political ideas would have to start with classical politics and from there work the way it's up to the present. As a matter of fact, I had worked through the materials, and a manuscript of several thousand pages was in existence. Still, the various misgivings that had arisen in the course of the work now crystallized into the understanding that the history of political ideas as such was a senseless undertaking, considering the present state of science. The ideas were a secondary conceptual development, beginning with the Stoics, intensified in the High Middle Ages, and radically developed since the 18th century. The problem is the transformation of symbols which express experiences into concepts which are assumed to refer to a reality other than the experience. And this reality other than the experience does not exist. The construction of ideas is a deformation of symbols and the experiences which they express. The points at which the misgivings arose were obvious. In the first place, there is no continuity of the so-called ideas from the Greek philosophers of the 7th to the 4th century BC. And for instance, the content of Israelite prophetic and New Testament revelatory writings. In the symbolizations of classic philosophy, of Israelite prophetism, Jewish apocalypse, and Christian revelation simply touch different areas of reality and are not developing in continuity problems of only one area. Moreover, the farther one went back into the background of the conventional origin of ideas with the Greeks, the alternative symbolizations, especially the myths and the symbols of revelation, became clear as not being ideas by any stretch of imagination. An Hesiodian theogony simply is not a philosophy in the Aristotelian sense. Even so, the experiences of reality expressed by, in the one case mystical, in the other case philosophical symbols, very intelligibly the same, as Aristotle already had remarked or observed. The problems were arising which I tried to express through such concepts as compact experience of the cosmos or primary experience of the cosmos and the differentiations which lead to the truth of existence in the Hellenic classic, the Israelite, and the early Christian sense. In order to characterize the decisive incision in the history of consciousness, I used at the time the term in quotation marks, leap in being, taking the term leap from Kierkegaard's Sprung. The focus of interest moved from ideas to the experiences of reality, which engendered symbols for their articulation. That is not to say that the problem of ideas now simply disappeared. Of course, it was very much present, but I only gradually found out what it is. Some important observations, which grew in clarity over the years, were the understanding that the transformation of experiences symbolized into doctrines concerning non-existent objects presupposed a deformation of existence in the sense that the contact with the reality of the experiences was lost, and the use of the language symbols engendered by the original experiences became a more or less empty game. Some of the most obvious things about this deformation I discovered rather late, only in the 1950s and 60s. For instance, I had not been aware, clearly, that the term metaphysics is not a Greek term, but an Arabic deformation of the Greek title of Aristotle's Metaphysica, that it had been taken over by Thomas and for the first time being used in a Western language in his introduction to the commentary on Aristotle's Metaphysics, and that ever since then there all of a sudden was an odd science that was called metaphysics. So not quite unjustified criticism of such doctrinal metaphysics in the Enlightenment and the period of early positivism did not touch the problems of philosophy as represented by the Greek philosophers, but that was not known at the time and is still little known today, because the cliché metaphysics has become the magic word by which one can throw out all philosophical exploration of reality. I had to give up the conception of ideas as ultimate objects of history and to establish the experience of reality, personal, social, historical, cosmic, as the reality to be explored. And one could explore these experiences only by exploring their articulation through symbols. This principle of establishing the subject matter and with the subject matter the method to be used led to the further principle that lies at the basis of all my later work, that the reality is self-interpretive. The man who has the experiences express them through symbols, and the symbols are the key to the understanding of the experiences. There is no sense in pretending that the Egyptian priests who wrote Theology of Memphis or the Mesopotamian priests who developed the Sumerian king list were enlightened ideologists of the 18th century and had no other problems than a Voltaire or a Comte or a Hegel. What is experienced as reality answer advance in the differentiation of experiences is the substance of history. The work on the history of political ideas had not been done in vain because it familiarized myself with the historical materials. But now the reorganization of these materials under the aspect of experience and symbolization became necessary. Hence I gave up the plan of a history of political ideas and started my work on order and history. At the time, the story had to begin with the Mesopotamian and Egyptian empires and the cosmological symbolization of personal and social order. From this background of the cosmological imperial symbolism came the breakthrough into the Israelite revelation, and not in continuity with it, but at a rather late date in this Near Eastern development, occurred parallel the outbreak of noetic thinking through the Greek philosophers. The study of the Near Eastern and Israelite experiences down to the period of Christ filled the first volume of Order and History. The evolution of the corresponding Greek experiences from the cosmological origins to the noetic differentiation filled the volumes 2 and 3. According to the original plan, these volumes were to be followed by studies on empire, medieval imperialism and spiritualism, and the modern development. That plan, however, proved unrealizable. Considerable parts of it were in fact written, but they always broke down on the question of volume. I always ran into the problem that in order to arrive at theoretical formulations, I had to present first the materials on which the theoretical formulation had to be based as an analytic result. If I went through with that program, the sequel to the first 3 volumes would have been not another 3 volumes as planned, but perhaps 6 or 7 volumes more. The cause of the difficulty, as I just explained, was that the general public was unfamiliar with the materials, which led to certain theoretical insights, so that the theoretical insights could not be presented without the materials. Over the years, I made therefore a number of special studies on certain problems of early Christianity, of the mythospeculative form of historiogenesis, on the transition from historiogenetic speculation into historiography, on the problem of the ecumene as developed by Herodotus and Polybius and by the Chinese historians, on certain modern theoretical problems, such as the engagement in an act of sorcery by Hegel in the construction of his system, and so forth. It seemed to make sense to fill two more volumes with these special studies, arriving more shortly at the theoretical results than to fill whole volumes with materials, because in the meanwhile, what I had seen as a problem in the 1940s and 50s had also seen by others, and the historical exploration of such problems as Gnosis, the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Nag Hammadi finds, the prehistory of Pseudo-Dionysius, the influence of Neoplatonism in the Renaissance and subsequent intellectual Western developments up to Hegel, had made enormous progress, so that now I could refer to the studies on the materials conducted by a great number of scholars, materials which were not accessible to the public in the 1940s and 50s, when I developed the conception of order and history. To stress the development just mentioned, because it could not be foreseen at the time when I started on my work. We are living today in a period of the advancement of the historical sciences and philosophical science that hardly has a parallel in the history of mankind. The fact that these enormous developments become accessible to the public through enterprising publishers rather than through a college personnel charged with the education of the young, that is, at a moderate estimate, 50 years behind the times, is one of the peculiarities in the contemporary structure of Western society. As a matter of fact, a number of theoretical assumptions from which I had started when I began to write Order and History had become obsolete through this rapid development of the historical sciences, especially regarding prehistory and archaeology. When I wrote the first volume of Order and History, my horizon was still limited by the Near Eastern empires. I identified the cosmological symbolism which I found there with the imperial symbolism of Mesopotamia and Egypt. On the basis of the new expansion of our prehistoric and archaeological knowledge, I can now say that practically all of the symbols which appear in the ancient Near East have a prehistory reaching through the Neolithicum back into the Paleolithicum for something like 20 or 30,000 years before the Near Eastern empires. The present theoretical problem would be to disengage the problem of cosmological symbolism from the problem of imperial symbolism, to deal with cosmological symbolisms on the tribal level on which they were developed back in the Stone Age, and then to analyze the differentiations introduced by the foundation of empires, as for instance in Egypt. I have collected the materials for this purpose, and I hope to publish my findings sometime in the future. Another great advance in science that has been in the making for many decades has more recently found its decisive support through the revision of the radiocarbon dates, beginning in 1966. The conception of a unilinear history that had already been quite shaky, if one considered the chronological parallel developments in the Near East, in China, in India, and in Hellas, now definitely breaks down when the temple cultures of Malta, for instance, can be dated substantial periods of time before the Pyramid Age in Egypt.